just get the deal done, promise, you know, whatever you have to say to get the contract inked. And that actually isn't good for anyone because you end up just under-delivering. The client is angry and it never ends well.
Hello and welcome to V for Visionaries podcast with me, Richard Ward. I am an award-winning serial entrepreneur with over 35 years experience in the beauty and media world. But today I'm most interested in finding out who are the movers and shakers in business, what makes them so successful, and why certain cream rises to the top.
And me, Rosamund Stenhouse. I am an award-winning fourth generation of entrepreneurs. I have spent several decades working with all aspects of land, delivering new towns and large-scale landmass for development. I now work with national and international entrepreneurs, scaling, improving sales, and expanding their business. This is the podcast where bold ideas meet business brilliance.
Yes, and each week we'll be sitting down with trailblazing entrepreneurs and industry leaders to uncover the strategies, the stories, and the secrets behind some of the world's most exciting business ventures. So in this very first episode, we will be talking to the MD of Thinking Hat Media, Nick Forster. So without further ado, welcome to V for Visionaries. Well, we are so excited today to have, oh my God, you have been so hard to pin down, Nick, but thankfully, here you are, finally. So welcome, Nick Forster, MD of Thinking Hat Media, a London-based PR and content agency. Now, your clients have absolutely blown me away. They read like a who's who of the business world. Your clients include Amazon, AWS, Deliveroo, TripAdvisor, and Zoopla. Wow. How on earth did you get those? I know that's what all the listeners are thinking. How did you get those clients? But before we delve too deeply into that, which trust me, we will, let me take you all the way back and just tell me where you grew up and do you come from an entrepreneurial background?
Hi, guys. It's an absolute pleasure to be on the podcast. Great to finally get it in the diary. I grew up in North Yorkshire. In a town called Harrogate, and really not from a massively entrepreneurial background. My dad was always in business, but you know, from a young age, he instilled in us that it was so important to be commercially minded and, you know, possibly do a different path than he'd taken. And I think he kind of tried to instill that in all of us, my brother and sister and I.
Was he from Yorkshire originally?
He was born in Northumberland.
And what about your mother? What was her background?
The same, really. She worked part-time growing up. She sort of looked after us kids, but she was a nurse. So she worked in a doctor's surgery as an NHS sister and did that right until sort of just after the pandemic. You know, very, very proud son here. I definitely think my background probably gave me, you know, the confidence and the vision to just sort of try and do something on my own.
So at some point you end up in London working for, and this is when your career really starts to go, before you set up your own agency, just run through. So you arrive in London and you do find, you get on the PR London ladder.
Yes. Yeah. So basically, I did a degree. I went to Leeds and did a PR degree. So I actually, you know, I went and did a sandwich year between my second and third year and worked in a national PR agency called Golly Slater. So I kind of got a year of experience. And then I found myself eventually back down in London. My first job was with Phil Hall, who was editor of the News of the World. We worked with Duncan Bannatyne on his book and Jacqueline Gold, Deborah Meaden. So, you know.
Why do you think, Nick? Why? Because a lot of people start in PR in agencies, maybe not as lucky as that start, but it doesn't mean they make anything of themselves. It doesn't mean they become a successful entrepreneur. And, you know, taking into account your father's principles, values and standards that clearly have embedded themselves with you and your mother, clearly, what was the point where you suddenly realized, okay, I can do this on my own? I'm going to make the leap. I'm going to try it. And why?
So I went on to work with Holly Tucker and Sophie Cornish, MBE at notonthehighstreet.com. So they brought me across to run PR and comms for them globally. And that was such a game-changing moment for me. You know, it really meant that I was working daily with these super intelligent, super motivated entrepreneurs who were building this huge business that was really kind of taking off at the time. And that really exposed me just to, you know, the world of startups and scale-ups. It was a really, really exciting time. It was a bit like a rocket ship. And I remember either Holly or Sophie, I can't remember which, but they just said, you know, this is a rocket ship and just strap yourself in and sort of enjoy the ride. And it was a hell of a ride.
Wow. So and then basically so you work with them for a few years and then you set up on your own.
Yeah, well, so there's another sort of job in the story. So which actually probably is the one that really pushed me to set up on my own. So through working with notonthehighstreet.com, one of their major investors was Index Ventures, which was very focused on seed stage. So giving early stage entrepreneurs their first investment. So investments of up to sort of £1 million. So it's working with sort of CEOs from day one, really.
And also I'm imagining you wanting to set up your own company, you must have been like a sponge seeing and working with all these young entrepreneurs, and actually you're helping them, but they're helping you at the same time, giving you fuel.
Absolutely. And it was infectious, you know, and contagious. And I kind of, that was where I started to, being around those kinds of people day in, day out, seeing the ambition and the drive and just the vision, you know, the cog started turning and I started thinking, you know, why aren't I doing this myself, basically? Why don't I go off and set up my own agency?
It's also a huge business exposure spread across section of different businesses that must have helped you to understand where the pitfalls were and where the areas of success is best to go for. So how did you make that leap?
So made that leap, I actually, and it comes full circle, this story, and it's actually, you know, I think all the best things in life do, really. But I saw on LinkedIn that my old colleague, Emma Healy and David Brooks, actually, there were three of us. There's now just two of us in the business. But they were setting up an agency. And I thought, you know, we should go for a drink or some dinner and, you know, get our heads together. We did that. We chatted and we decided, you know, let's go on this mission together. Let's create an agency that is purely for entrepreneurs, game-changing brands, you know, people trying to do things differently, really leading the charge, disrupting. And that was kind of the genius of the idea, really, for the agency that became Thinking Hat.
You know, Nick, you just used a word there that I think it's one of my favorite words in business that I've probably learned in the last 10 years, and it's disrupting in business, to be a disruptive business. I remember a very good friend of mine who's made a lot of money on the stock market has said to me he only invests in disruptive businesses. So just going on to you set up this business and you want to work with all these different, you've got a good idea of who you want to work with. Now, for all of our listeners out there, I think the one question that I think if you're looking to start your own business or people that maybe already have their own business and have a partner, now you start this business with three partners. Are you all bringing something different to the table? One. And do you think if you've got partners, if you're all doing the same thing, can that work? Or learning the lessons that you've now clearly learned, and you're now telling me there's only two of you. So what's your view on having and how difficult it is to start up a business with a partner?
I think that was exactly it. We all brought something very different to the table. I probably brought the tech and entrepreneur side. Emma, who is my co-founder, is still my co-founder, very much the consumer side and influencer marketing. And then Brookie, partner number three, was very much the kind of the business side and looking at, you know, the commercials and the actual sort of cogs of sort of how the business would run. So I think we had very clear roles. And that's why it worked. I think we would have struggled in those early days if we'd all been trying to kind of do the same thing. I think very early on, you know, we had a mantra that, you know, we would stay in our lane and we would kind of defer to the other person that was in charge of that domain. Because I think if you're all trying to kind of wrestle for the steering wheel, then I think that could be a recipe for disaster.
100%. Do you think, and this is often what co-founders or multiple partners experience, at some point you start off one person with very clear vision, very clear goals. And then in time, as you all adjust and learn and the company gets bigger and there's more interesting, you know, there's money coming in and there's the payoff of what money brings. Often with that, that's when you see partnerships start to flounder, is when the egos start to grow. And unless you are completely committed 1,000% to the company and almost mold yourself to live and breathe that company, it's very easy to derail and get lost in the who's who or the, I mean, it's very typical. Would you say that is something that other people listening or other entrepreneurs, how would you overcome that in hindsight?
I think it's really important, firstly, just, you know, ego is just such a business killer. You know, I think we were all very good at keeping a lid on that. And I think it really is like a marriage, you know, and I think it's so important to really kind of put as much effort into, you know, your business relationship as you would actually your personal relationships. And I think it's just about trying to stay on the same page.
Exactly. So just fast forwarding. So just tell the listeners. So I just want to drill down a little bit into the numbers. I mean, is this a lucrative business to be in? And I mean, obviously, from the business that I come from, it's a bit similar to you. So we sort of sell time because everyone in your office or if you're working on an account, it's time. It's your time that they're buying. Right. So you are so each of you has a finite amount of time. So I would imagine they pay a certain amount of money a month. Right. They pay a certain amount of money a month. And for that, they get this, this and this and this. Just talk me through. Is this a business that you think you can scale? Because I would imagine being a completely ignorant, really, about the PR world. Is this a business you can scale or is this just a business really ultimately you can just make a good living out of?
Yeah, I think it, you know, most certainly is a business you can scale, I think. And I think that's definitely, you know, the plan for us. We absolutely, you know, want this to be a global agency. And, you know, at the moment we've got clients here, we've got clients in the US, we've got a couple in Europe, but the plan is to just keep growing and building that. It is very lucrative if you can find the right clients and if you can build the right team. That, you know, teams are expensive, but I think if you can build a team that delivers and does what it says it will, but it is also quite lean. You know, I think we have about 15 of us currently, and it's a lean team, but we sort of punch above our weight. We really deliver for clients. And, you know, we're kind of all about, not sort of being too sort of bloated as an organization. I like the you know, the analogy of a speedboat and an oil tanker. I think in the types of clients we work with, you need to be fairly scrappy and fairly sort of agile. And that's how we work. But the, you know, the answer is, I think, like anything, if you build it right and you can secure the sort of contracts necessary, then it's been quite lucrative for us.
Can I ask you, who does the hiring?
We all take quite an active role in that. You know, we are, there's a small bunch of us, and someone, if you hire the wrong person, it can really upset the apple cart.
Now, somebody like me, who has spent his life in business hiring PRs, just talk to me about how difficult or not difficult it is having these clients with high expectations. So let me give you an example. You create the monster, right? You create this monster, and the person that you've created, or the business, the monster business you've created, then becomes unsatisfied or not satisfied with what you're doing, and they want more and more and more. How do you manage that with clients?
Well, I think you said the magic word, manage, and I think it's all about managing expectations, and from the outset, really being clear on, you know, the KPIs, what good looks like, you know, having maybe sort of a KPI and a stretch KPI. You know, in an ideal world, we'll deliver XYZ, but if we can't quite get there, then if we land this, then that's also good. And making sure that clients understand that, you know, PRs are beholden to the media. We are not, you can't put a release out there. You can't call a journalist and guarantee coverage.
100%.
What do you tell clients in order to manage expectations? It's probably the biggest downfall in PR companies. There's a lot of pressure on, there's a lot of competition, and there is an expectation to overpromise and underdeliver because they don't manage 100%. The expectations. And it's probably what crashes more, you know, contracts or deals than anything. Mm. How do you just say to Absolutely. Them, whatever your expectation, in walk me through how you do that with a client?
I think so. Very, very honest conversations from day one, really. I think it's very easy to overpromise. And in the past, I've worked in agencies where the mentality is just get the deal done, promise, you know, whatever you have to say to get the contract inked, and then we'll worry about it later. I think what we do is, and that actually isn't good for anyone, because you end up under delivering, your team feel terrible, the client is angry, and no one feels very good, and it just, yeah, it kind of, it never ends well. So I think just communicating, and, you know, if
you... Can I take you back, because there's something bothering me. You were mentioning about a tip. I think this is a very important point. Everything comes down, you're in a company, you're as good as the people that work with you. I'm sure you'll agree with that. You're about to mention about this tip. When you are going through the process of hiring someone and you're getting to know them, what is the characteristics you're looking for that will make sure you don't end up with a dud employee, or someone who's lazy, or someone who's... I mean, we used to hold them for 2.5 hours. It sounds brutal. But when we were hiring for maybe CFO or anyone in the finance side that really needed to be level, and of course, CVs are often absolutely not worth, you know, the paper they're written on. So we used to keep them. And at about 2 hours, after about 2 hours, they used to collapse and all the real stuff used to come out. How do you do it?
That's a great idea. I've never done that one before. Yeah, we try to see people in different, you know, circumstances. If it's a senior role, then, you know, maybe 2 or 3 face-to-face interviews, and then, you know, a dinner with the team, and you see in social situations as well, people's guards come down, and you maybe see slightly more of the real character, and you know, after a few drinks as well, you tend to see you know, people's reserves go down, and so I think it's about really engaging with candidates in a number of situations, a number of social settings, and reading between the lines. You know, I think after sort of hiring for as many years as we have been, I think you get quite depth, reading CVs.
I think also you develop an intuition, and over time, experience really does matter, and an emotional intelligence that grows with that as you are forced to better understand people. But I think at the end of the day, there's always that element of a roll of the dice with any person. But you seem quite an intuitive entrepreneur, quite an intuitive leader.
I think I'm quite an emotional person. I think I'm quite emotionally led, probably more heart over head sometimes. I think I'm a people person, and I'd say 8 times out of 10, usually I'm right about someone, or, you know, what they're going to be good at, or, you know, their character. You don't get it right every time. It's always a bit of a roll of the dice. But I think the more times you do it, sort of the better you get at it, I guess.
Can I just drill down into just a little bit more about the your business and the PR side? Correct me if I'm wrong. There's a downturn in business. There is a recession on. PR is the first to be axed. So you are quite exposed in some ways, aren't you, to the economy and how it's going and how business is going?
Absolutely. You no doubt there that you are exposed. And I think marketing PR is generally the first thing in a recession to be looked at and sort of put under the microscope. What's important in bearing that in mind is to just really make sure that you're not putting all of your eggs in one basket. So rather than, you know, and this sort of goes back to us building a general agency, rather than having, you know, clients all in one sector or only doing consumer PR, what we've tried to build is a content arm of the business, which is more, you know, video and content writing, blogging. We've got the, you know, consumer PR, we've got corporate PR, and then sort of more crisis management and influencer management on the side. So, yeah, but I think it's tough. You know, it's very tough out there at the moment. It really, you know, I speak to other agency owners a lot, and they're you know, people are really kind of finding it challenging. And I think budgets are, you know, constricting, and we're having to kind of adapt and, you know, sometimes one part of the business is up and another is slightly down. So
that is definitely, you're not alone with that. I don't think there's a single entrepreneur out there that isn't constantly putting out fires. And I always joke, entrepreneurs are just problem solvers.
Nick, you said something which I just got to pick up on. You said something, and I say this so often. You said, you know, actually, it's quite tough out there at the moment. I've never been in business ever once in all of my 32 years and said, do you know what? It's really piss easy out there at the moment. It's a walk in the park. When you realize it was a walk in the park and it was easy is when you come out of those good times and you go into the bad times and you look back and think how good things were.
Absolutely. That is so true. It really is. It's kind of, you sometimes you don't know what you've got until it's gone. But I think that's the nature of entrepreneurs as well. I think when you're an entrepreneur, you don't want to think of things as being easy. I think we are natural problem solvers, and so naturally you're sort of looking for what can we fix? What can we do? What can we do better? You know,
There's also an element of adrenaline that comes into it. Is the constant, you know, there's a new thing on the horizon. That's one area I want to cover. You have very impressive clients. A lot of people maybe would be unable to go after clients and retain and keep clients like that, based on their maybe, you know, the fear.
We're talking Amazon, Deliveroo, TripAdvisor, Zoopla. I mean, that's serious clients, Nick.
They are serious clients. I think, you know, it goes back to that old saying, you know, your network is your net worth. And I think PR and the media game and content, it's all around network. And that is something over the past 10 years, we've just networked our socks off, really. And whether that's with journalists or with communications directors or CEOs, you know, I think London is quite a small place in terms of the the marketing professions, different industries. So I think we've always made an effort to really get out there and meet people. I also think it goes without saying that we were very sort of fortunate to sign Amazon very early days. And that in itself has given us traction. And, you know, I think people started to take us seriously. And, you know, having that first Amazon contract, we then managed to turn that into, we worked our asses off. We then managed to turn that into maybe two or three more contracts with Amazon. Then other people start taking notice and you get meetings with it. You know, so it's a snowball.
Also, Nick, I'm now thinking with my business hat on, that's also going to attract good people to come and work for you, with you.
Absolutely. It's so much easier to get talented and really passionate staff when, you know, you have sexy clients and, yes, you know, that helps you sort of grow your business. And so it really is, it's a bit of a snowball. And yeah, it, you know, there's no doubt that signing that first Amazon contract was a real game changing day for us as a business.
Can I ask you, what is the structure of your company? How do you retain employees?
We just try and look after the team, basically. We have clear sort of structure lines, and, you know, making sure as well that people have fun. I think, you know, it's, someone once said to me, it's, you know, it's PR, not ER. And, you know, you kind of want people to be enjoying their job. So taking them out, you know, giving them benefits, giving them kind of health cover. And, you know, we have Vitality, which means you can get, you know, free coffees or whatever, having a great office space as well. We have, you know, massages and ping pong tables and, you know, all, wow, the,
yeah, all we're coming over. Wow. The over data.
all the, you know, all the things now that people, I think, maybe didn't put value on, what, certainly, yes, when I was starting.
You've got to try and create somewhere, Nick, haven't you, where the staff don't want to leave.
Exactly. Exactly.
Paying them right, sexy clients and good bosses to work for. That's it.
And good benefits, you know, kind of, and it's a real cliche and I hate it when people say, oh God, we're a family here and it, you know, but we really do try and create that kind of family feel. And the worst thing, and one thing I just hate to be, is a really remote boss that doesn't know the people who are actually working with them. And I think we're really tight, you know, we tackle clients as a team. So hopefully there's never just one person that the client, you know, feels is looking after them. Hopefully they feel like it's a real team effort, which helps as well.
No, Nick, you're clearly an incredibly nice man. It's evident. One question, I'm going to put you on the spot for a second. You work for VCs, okay? So you would have seen all, yes, the startups you were describing. And when a startup is built within a VC, they know the exit, because obviously they're going to sell it on. Or how have you packaged your company, and did you?
So we basically, it's a really good question, Roz. And I think, you know, working at Forward Partners, the rule was always, you know, this investment has to deliver 10x of what we put into it. So if you're investing, you know, $1 million, you're looking to get 10 million back. Or I think with us, this our business was always very much, well, more emotional than that. We didn't necessarily go into it with a plan of exiting. I guess it's a bit like Richard's business in a sense. It's when you're passionate about what you're doing and you're doing it day to day, it becomes a lifestyle business. You're not thinking, what can I make out of this? Or, you know, I want to sell it.
Were you?
perhaps I should have been. I think going down the route, sort of, you know, over the past eight years old now, really along the way, we've definitely had those conversations amongst the directors about, look, what do we need to, what does exiting look like? When do we realistically think we will want to exit? What would the magic number be? You know, I think at the moment, it's not even on our radar. You know, it's very much, you know, possibly in another 10 years' time. But I think
it's, sometimes if there is a VC exposure, they will, you know, write in the exit in the beginning. But I think the many entrepreneurs only create an exit when they get to a certain age and they start to actually look at what is my retirement, how am I going to achieve it? And then, of course, when children come along, they're thinking about what am I going to buy them, their first home, can I do it? Nick, we have 5 to 10 minutes left. And it's a tradition on this podcast that we ask guests 3 questions.
Wow, okay.
Sounds bad. Right, the first question I'll ask one, Richard's going to ask two, is if you could go back to anywhere in your life in time, whether it's good, bad, ugly, what is the one moment that you wish you could have either said yes to or no to or changed?
I would go back and probably say, you know, possibly high school or university years, and just say, you know, have the confidence in yourself. I remember being, you know, 18, 19, early 20s, and just not having masses of confidence and limiting myself probably through that, not really seeing that anything is possible. And I think it's only now, you know, pushing 40, you kind of look back and you think, God, you know, I had the world at my feet, you know, I could have done anything. Coming to London, you know, it probably took me a good 2 or 3 years to really find my feet, I felt like a fish out of water for years. I didn't come from the same place as most of the people I was working with. And, you know, I just say be confident and everything will work out.
But, you know, I remember, I was only thinking this the other day because listening to a podcast, I was listening to the footballer Joey Barton, who literally comes from absolute Toxteth, I think, it's in Liverpool.
Yeah.
And he's you know, nobody, you know, he's made it, and he's saying, you know, he's a multimillionaire and he's played for England and Man City and all the rest of it. The one thing he said, you know, people used to say to him, nobody makes anything coming out of here. Nobody, you can't be anything coming out of here. Mm. And I remember thinking, not that I am, but I remember saying to my parents, you know, you look at the people on Top of the Pops or whatever it was back in the day, and you think, I want to be like that. But you can't be like that coming from Folkestone. You can't.
Yeah.
And I remember my dad saying to me, well, of course you can.
It's so true. I remember feeling a million miles from London growing up and feeling there was always something in me, a little voice that said, like, you've got to get to London, like, get to London. You know, it was like a sort of attractor beam pulling me in, and I knew that it felt miles away, but I knew that if I could get to London, then I could, you know, I had a chance. And which seems silly, you know. There's millions of successful people in Harrogate as well, but it really attracted me, the lifestyle, Nick, and the, you know.
But Nick, so you haven't helped the North-South divide then at all, have you? They must bloody hate you up there coming up to London.
I think for PR, you know, being in London is definitely helpful, but, you know, I also love going back to the North, and I obviously am based here, but North is...
Let him put you on the
go home, smash and grab, take what you want out of it and piss off back to London. Right.
Yeah.
Second question. What's your favourite music and why? Just what's your favourite music?
I would say soul. Love a bit of old soul, bit of Barry White, all of that stuff. Motown, that would probably be my go-to.
Perfect answer. Okay, last question. Fantastic. And I think I know what you're going to say, because I think you said it already in the podcast. Who is the person that most influenced you? Well, let's say in your private life, let's say in your personal life, and who's the person that most influenced you in your business life?
My parents. I'm going to say them both in my personal life, just because I'll get in trouble if I pick one. they definitely, from, you know, in many ways, in kind of how to just be a decent human, how to do business, how to, you know, do get up and be passionate about things and don't sort of half-ass it. That was kind of their the way they brought us up. But then in business, I would say my biggest inspiration was probably Sophie Cornishat, not on the high street. She was an incredible person to work with and just very inspirational. So, and really kind of taught me a lot about being an entrepreneur and being, driven and having that vision and the unstoppable kind of drive, really.
Nick, we're going to end now, but I just want to thank you immensely for being such a great podcast person. And I'm going to take away from this, I think the emphasis that you placed on the importance of communicating, regular communication within a firm, within a company, and how relevant that actually is, because it starves off potential fires or issues that may arise. And I think for me, that was the most valuable.
100%. And just for me, I think, and for everyone that's listening, I just think that, you know, your problems that you have in business, it's the same as everybody else. We're all facing the same thing. It doesn't matter what business you're in. I think that screams loud and clear. The way you treat your staff, the way you nurture them. And I know you said you hate using the word a family business, but you know, they are family. Well, that's exactly what comes across. So Nick Forster, from Thinking Hat Media, thank you so much. You've been an absolute inspiration, not just to us, but to all of our listeners as well. Thank you so much.
Thank you, guys. It's been an absolute pleasure. Thank you for being such generous hosts and having so much fun. It's been fun.
Another huge thanks to Nick Forster from Thinking Hat Media, and an even bigger thanks to you for listening to this episode of V for Visionaries.
Wherever you're listening, we would love it if you could take a moment to subscribe and hit 5 stars, and we will see you in the next episode.